From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. The economics of a network television show used to be pretty straightforward. Get high ratings in the right demographic, and you can charge lots of money for commercial time. But network television is losing viewers to cable and the internet, so the business model is changing too. Friday Night Lights on NBC Tonight represents the change. Its ratings are low, but the show, about a small-town football team, is earning money through a one-of-a-kind deal with a satellite TV provider. Nate DeMeo reports on the remaking of the network television business model.
All right, listen up.
Coach Taylor needs a miracle. His Panthers have gone into the locker room down 27 at the half. His offensive line is being steamrolled.
Coach Spivey, we're going to readjust. Base defense, press coverage. We are not going to allow any more big plays tonight, gentlemen.
Friday Night Lights premiered to great reviews 3 years ago. The story of a football-obsessed Texas town was praised for its realistic portrayal of lives in the American working and middle classes, which is a surprisingly hard thing to find these days in American television. But so is an audience. And head writer Jason Kadem says the show needed a miracle of its own.
It seemed fairly certain that the show was going to be canceled. And what happened was, through what I consider sort of a stroke of genius, they came up with this idea.
The satellite television company, DirecTV, was looking for a cheap way to bring an exclusive show to its lineup. NBC had a good show that wasn't making any money. So DirecTV bought the rights to air the new season of Friday Night Lights before anyone, even NBC. And the network took that money to prop up a program that was otherwise doomed. The show's third season recently completed its run on DirecTV and has now started up all over again from its first episode on NBC.
Tara, I really do hate this paper.
In this scene from the show, Landry, the smart and sensitive Panthers bench warmer, helps Tyra, the one-time bad girl trying to make good, with her college entrance essay. And Landry manages to defer some of the show's production costs along the way.
Well, okay, like what?
Would you explain to me why every paragraph has to tie back into Applebee's?
Because I use it as a metaphor. It works.
It seems that everything on this show ties back to Applebee's, or Gatorade, or Vaseline for Men. Writer Jason Kadem explains that integrating products into shots and storylines has become part of his job, and he says it's been okay so far. It feels realistic to have Gatorade on the sidelines on a football show. One of his main characters is a don't-mess-with-Texas guy who owns a car dealership. It makes sense he'd sell Chevys.
We kind of feel like we want to do everything in our power to keep the show going.
And between the product placement, the DirecTV deal, and some production belt tightening, Friday Night Lights is getting another crack at finding an audience beyond its cult fan base. But how is that going to happen if that fan base has already had a chance to see it on DirecTV? Alan Sepinwall is the TV critic at the Newark Star-Ledger.
They've created this odd situation which really only has precedent in the case of shows that aired previously in England and then came here, like Doctor Who, where the entire season was available to pirate and download in advance. So I think a lot of the really hardcore Friday Night Light fans have already found a way to see it, even if they don't have DirecTV.
The hope is that those fans will proselytize on the show's behalf. Eric Shanks of DirecTV points out that the show is now getting two sets of reviews and articles and radio stories written about it. This could turn out to be the TV equivalent of something that already works really well for the movie industry.
It's award season, right? There is an enormous amount of buzz for movies that have been in very limited release right now. When they win awards, those movies become hugely popular.
For his part, Jason Kadem's would probably accept slightly popular. He's seen too many good shows get canceled before their time.
If this experiment works for us, but also can sort of be an answer to other shows that are really good shows but are struggling to find an audience right now, that would be an amazing thing to be part of.
But meanwhile, he'll hope that the NBC run is good enough to allow him to keep a show going that he, and at least a few people, love. Even if it also means that you can expect more characters driving to Applebee's in their Chevys while chugging Gatorade. For NPR News, I'm Nate DeMeo.
The latest major company to announce job cuts is an iconic one. Harley-Davidson says it will close plants and cut about 1,100 jobs over the next 2 years. Today's announcement is expected to hit hardest in the motorcycle company's home city of Milwaukee. And from Milwaukee, Chuck Quirnbach of Wisconsin Public Radio sent us this story.
During its 106 years in business, Harley-Davidson has survived the Great Depression, several recessions, and stiff foreign competition. Still, the firm has enjoyed strong sales for most of the last 25 years, with large and dedicated groups happy to ride their bikes and wear the Harley colors. but domestic sales of Harleys have been sliding over the last year or so. At the same time, the foreign market has fallen off. Harley spokesman Bob Klein says while the company still posted a profit of $654 million last year, job cuts are necessary.
We are making the moves that we announced today to deal with the current economy and what we see for the year ahead, as well as to right-size the business going forward.
Harley plans to cut production by 13% this year. To do that, it'll combine two engine plants, close a Wisconsin parts distribution center, and cut some jobs in Pennsylvania. Harley workers contacted for this story said they were advised not to talk to the media today. But dealers and customers did talk about the dent in Harley's carefree image. The house of Harley-Davidson in suburban Milwaukee services and sells hundreds of motorcycles a year, including this Street Glide model. Goran Zadrima is the sales manager here and says the slide in sales during this recession is worrisome.
Everybody's at this point everywhere freaking out. Everything is slow. But I think also has a lot to do with how you set up your attitude towards that. If we go after every customer and do the right thing, and I think we'll be fine.
But because Harley finances more than half of all bikes it sells, some of the financial pain comes from customers not paying their loans. With the average cost of a bike at about $15,000, monthly loans can pinch the family budget. Even so, this dealership plans to increase its sales force in the spring, hoping the upper-middle-class customers it depends on will keep buying. As she left the store this morning, Raylan Foyt clutched her bag of Harley jewelry and said she's not giving up on Harley-Davidson.
Because I've been riding for 10 years and like the culture, like the people that we meet, so want to help Harley keep their jobs.
The expected loss of well-paying manufacturing jobs does mean more financial pain for the Milwaukee area, which still has an unemployment rate below the national average. Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett says the Harley layoffs will hurt, but that the local economy is resilient.
This is a blow. I'm not going to disguise this and say it's not a blow, but I believe that because we have so many different sectors in this economy, that we will not be hit as hard as other parts of this country.
But Mayor Barrett says he isn't sure just how quickly laid-off motorcycle workers will be able to switch to building the very roads and bridges that those still riding Harley-Davidsons will need. For NPR News, I'm Chuck Quirnbach in Milwaukee.
One of the actors in Inkheart is someone you might have seen before, even if you can't place him. He's the man behind Gollum in The Lord of the Rings, and he starred as the giant gorilla in Peter Jackson's King Kong. In Inkheart, he plays a human character named Capricorn.
He's the evil villain of Inkheart. He's played by Andy Serkis, who joins us now from our studios in New York. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Hi.
This is a really fun film, and your character, the bad guy, Capricorn, decides that he really likes living in reality. He likes being out of the world of the book. And I'm wondering how you approach that. I mean, most of us are used to living in reality, so how do you get it in your mind that reality is a whole new gig?
I don't know. I think I spend most of my time not living in reality, actually. But Capricorn, to tell you about the character himself, he is Inkheart. He is the character with a heart as black as ink. And he is nothing in that world of the book. And so when he gets to this world, he's absolutely paranoid about being sent back into it and does everything in his power to stop that from happening, which basically involves terrorizing an entire village.
There's a great speech that you give where you talk about how much you love living in this modern world and all the great things about it. And one of the number one examples was duct tape.
Yeah. He's a man who enjoys what this world has to offer in terms of adornment and material goods. And duct tape is just one of the very useful things that his henchmen manage to use rather a lot of the time to keep his opposers quiet, you know.
I'd like to take a listen to a bit of your performance as Gollum in the second Lord of the Rings film, The Two Towers. It was a very bipolar role. It was an amazing performance, not just physically, but also vocally for you. Let's take a listen to this clip.
Master's my friend.
You don't have any friends. Nobody likes you.
Not listening. Not listening.
You're a liar.
No.
Murderer.
Andy Serkis, the Academy said you couldn't be nominated for that performance, even though there was a lot of Oscar buzz around it, because there was digital manipulation involved in your character. Do you think that that's fair as we continue to see more and more technology in films? Do you think that, that those kind of standards are fair?
I mean, I personally think that actors' performances in films are enhanced in a million different ways, down to the choice of camera shot by the director, whether it's in slow motion or whether it's quick cut, or whether the choice of music behind the close-up or the costume that you're wearing or the makeup. You know, actors' performances do not stand alone in any film, live action or whatever. And performance capture is no different. Yes, there is a certain amount of enhancement, but it doesn't alter the nature of the performance. And that's, I think, really what is of core importance to understand and what people are starting to understand.
You're slated to play the role of British rocker Ian Dury in an upcoming film. And Ian Dury isn't too widely known here in the U.S., but can you tell us a little bit about him and what about that role that you're looking forward to?
Yeah, I'm very excited about this. Ian Dury was the proto-punk in the 1970s, when the music scene in the UK was very, just come out of the hippie movement, and due to the kind of political unrest and the rise of Thatcherism and the kind of disaffected youth in Britain at the time, there was a real kind of upsurge of grassroots bands coming through the British pub scenes. And Ian Dury is one of those stories, and a great story. He was a polio sufferer and had a withered left arm and left leg, and classically, he was too old to be a rock star. He was, you know, but he had this brilliant energy and fantastic ability to write great lyrics. So, in a way, he was prior to the punk movement and part of that generation. But he also had this. I mean, in our story, and what's wonderful about our story is his the love for his family. So this kind of schism between the passion for his music and the complete and utter desire to get out there and basically shake everything up, kind of completely collides with his family and his children. And so we've got this wonderful script together which portrays his life, and he really is an extraordinary man. And he says, you know, be magnificent, life's short, get out there, you can do it, everyone can do it, everyone. It's a really positive film. It's not a normal rock biopic, actually, about sort of, you know, drugs and leaving the family and kind of, you know, doing your thing. And it's really life-affirming. He's such an incredibly life-affirming human being.
Andy Serkis plays Capricorn in the film Inkheart. He joined us from NPR studio in New York. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oscar nominations came out this morning. The Curious Case of Benjamin Button had the most nominations with 13, and Slumdog Millionaire had 10. Joining those movies in the Best Picture category, Milk, Frost Nixon, and The Reader. And there's a complete list of Oscar nominees at our website, npr.org/movies. Please check that out. But first, we wanted to check out what our film critic, Bob Mandello, has to think about all this. And he joins us now in the studio. Hello, Bob.
Hey, it's good to be here.
Let's first talk about a big surprise. Small movie, Frozen River.
That's true. It's a very small movie to have gotten two major awards. A lot of people haven't seen it yet. It's about a Mohawk woman in upstate New York who sort of coerces a white woman into helping her smuggle illegal immigrants across the Canadian border.
I'm not going anywhere until those people get out of my trunk.
I'll give you half. Now let's go. Let's go!
I'm not taking them across the border. It's a crime.
There's no border here. This is free trade between nations.
This isn't a nation.
Let's go!
Melissa Leo got a Best Actress nomination for playing Ray, the white woman. And Courtney Hunt, who also directed, got an original screenplay nomination. I actually, between that and I've been walking around all day saying, "The Reader? The Reader?" How did that get in there? And I finally realized it's the Weinstein Brothers movie. And they're the guys who at Miramax used to be able to turn small movies into big award pictures, and they've done it again.
So we move now from small films and big surprises to big films. And Bob, you don't seem to like The Curious Case of Benjamin Button quite as much as the Academy does. Why not?
Well, I think it's all right. This is, life is like a box of digital effects, was my reaction to that one. It's okay. It's fine. But I think the reason that the Academy seems to be so excited about it is that it's a romance, so it can get lots of acting nominations. And it's also a special effects movie, so it can get all that little stuff, you know, the best special effects and
we're talking about a man
costumes
ages backward and all the effects
right.
That go along with doing that.
The only times that a picture has gotten more than 13 nominations were Titanic and All About Eve. Well, think about Titanic. It's a romance with special effects, so that follows that. All About Eve came out in 1950 at a time when they split everything between black and white and color pictures. There were a whole lot more awards back then. That's why it got 14. So there are anomalies, and I think this one fits into the pattern of that.
I, for the record, happen to like The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, so...
I'm really glad. I didn't dislike it. I just, you know, I think life is like a box of digital effects.
Now, what was left off the Academy's list?
Well, the one that everybody's talking about got left off for Best Picture and Best Director, Dark Knight, the Batman movie, which is the most popular movie of the last decade. It has made more money, almost $1 billion worldwide. And then also people are talking about how WALL-E got left off of the Best Picture because you've got this category now of Best Animated Picture, and otherwise it probably would have been in there. This category, which has become sort of a ghetto for animated films, is now a Pixar category to lose, it seems to me. Every time they have a picture come out, it ends up there and it ends up winning. So I think WALL-E will be no exception. It's an extraordinary movie.
February 22nd is the big night. So what if someone hasn't seen many of these movies, wants to study up before the Academy Awards on February 22nd? What should they go out and see?
Well, actually, the Academy, through its choices, has made that really easy this year. You'll be comfortable in all of the major categories if you see just 8 movies. 4 of them are the Best Picture nominees, excluding The Reader, which I don't think has a chance. And if, in addition to that, you see Doubt, Rachel Getting Married, and Frozen River for Best Actress, and The Wrestler for Best Actor, I think you will have seen everything that you need to see to win your office pool, so assuming the major categories are like that. You know, the one thing that I think you should not leave off that list because you think you might not enjoy it is Slumdog Millionaire, which I know people are coming to it late. You know, they're sort of discovering it late. It hasn't opened all over the country yet. But when it does, it is just this wonderful picture, a fantastical romance about a kid who is from the Indian slums, gets on the TV show Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
It's getting hot in here.
Are you nervous?
What? Am I nervous? It's you who's in the hot seat, my friend.
Oh, yes.
That's Dev Patel in Slumdog Millionaire playing Jamal, the lead character who's supposed to be in the hot seat on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire but seems to be the calm one there.
He does seem to be.
But there probably aren't a lot of calm people in Hollywood right now
well,
waiting for
point,
the
no.
big day. I know you don't like to make predictions, so I won't even ask you. But I will encourage our listeners to go to our website again. That's npr.org/movies if they want to find out more about these nominations. Thanks so much, Bob.
It's always a pleasure.
And that was our film critic, Bob Mondello.